Welcome everyone to another week of Parsha Insights, another double Parsha. We've always had a few of them back to back, almost back to back to back. We had Emor in between, but we have this week Parsha Insights, Baharam Dechukosai, and the Ezras Hashem were able to say, Gezunta Heis, Chazak Chazak Vinitz Chazek, completing Sefer Vayikra. We should be Zoicha with Bamidbar and with Devorim. The rest of the Chamishei Chumshei Torah to also be able to say Chazak, Chazak, Vinitz Chazek. Each and every one of the Chamishei Chumshei Torah, we should be Zoicha to learn, to hopefully get Chizuk, strive to become better people, and to be able to do it Gizunta Hei. So to all those who are finishing with another double Parsha, Baharam Bechukaisai, Parsha Insights, Chazak, Chazak, Vinitz Chazek. This year is Lezecher Nishmas Ule Ilu Nishmas. Rebecca Bas Serina and Leon Ben Rachel, may their neshama Torahs have a lichtige gan eden. Part of what we're going to say in a few moments is going to be a thought that we said, it's actually the Bar Yosef. I would hope that people shared it with you because it was literally something that so struck people that you brought to my attention. Some of us heard the Bar Yosef over Shabbos, but I want to share parts of it with you because of how extraordinary it is. But let's only get to that in a few moments. There's a tremendous pshat from Reb Moshe. Reb Moshe brings down, if you take a look in Parshas Bahar, we learn about Oinoas Mamoin and Oinoas Dvorim. Take a look, please, at Chof Hei Yudalim. In Chof Hei Yudalad, there we are told, Bahar Chof Hei Yudalad, Loisoinu Ish Es Ochiv, not to go ahead or victimize or grieve one another. Rashi tells us this is talking about Oinoas Mamoin, when you abuse somebody in a financial sense. If you take a look, but a few psukim later in Yud Zayin, the Pasuk says, V'leisoinu, that's the same word again, V'leisoinu isha samisai. And here Rashi tells us this is a reference to Oinoas Dvorim, verbal abuse, harmful and hurtful words. While it's not the thrust of the shir, and I'm honored, I can't say in the Heichal, but in Gan Ariel that we have so many that are here, which means whether you're listening to the Parsha Insights this week from the Gan, or you're listening to the recording live, or to the many who will hear it when it's sent out, I hope everybody will have chizuk and it will enhance our Shabbos Kodesh. So these few psukim back to back of Leisainu, one is Oinoas Mamoin and one is Oinoas Dvorim, which means one is not to victimize or grieve or monetarily, financially abuse a person, and the other is a reference to verbal abuse. As I said, it's a shir that we gave a few years ago, so I don't want to spend more than literally a minute, perhaps two, repeating what we said. It's not the point of tonight's shir, but certainly worth quickly repeating. This juxtaposition of really learning Oinoas Dvorim together with Oinoas Mamoin. Years ago, perhaps 2025, I thought of something that I think is very true. If the two are being juxtaposed and equated with each other, then perhaps we need to learn, how does one violate Oinoas Mamoin? Not to aggrieve and financially abuse somebody in a monetary sense. There are two things you're not allowed to do. We learn from the Gemara, you're not allowed to overcharge, nor are you allowed to underpay. Overcharging, as we've said many times, would be unfair to the one making the purchase. Underpaying would be unfair to the one trying to make the sale. If we are learning Oinoas Dvorim in conjunction with Oinoas Mamoin, shouldn't we extrapolate and say, the same way that there are two things that you're not allowed to do in a monetary sense, don't overcharge and don't underpay, then when it comes to words, Oinoas Dvorim will also be violated if you overcharge and if you underpay. Overcharging means you spoke when you should have been silent. And underpaying means you were silent when you should have spoken up. That person needed you. They were being bullied. That person, nobody is coming to their defense. That person needed a kind word. They needed to hear something compassionate. and you remain silent. In fact, subsequent to my thinking of this, somebody showed me that the Zohar brings down that in the next world, equal to the punishment that there will be for one who spoke when he should have remained silent, equal to that is a punishment for remaining silent when you should have spoken up. I therefore think it's fair to say the same way that Einoah's mumbling is violated when you overcharge or you underpay, equal to that, similar to that, is Einoah's dvarim. Don't overcharge and don't underpay. Overcharging would mean, as we said, twice speaking when you should have been silent, and underpaying would mean that you remain silent when you should have spoken up. This is a shiur that we gave a couple years ago, and there's certainly a lot to say about it. Rav Moshe, Zecher Tzadik L'Kodesh Livracha, brings down such a beautiful idea in commenting of the juxtaposition of Einoah's Dvarim and Einoah's Mamayim. They are found in the parsha between the laws of Shvius, which of course means the laws of Shemitah of the seventh year. In fact, if you take a look at the beginning of the parsha, before these two psukim, the first being a reference to Einoah's Mamon and the second being a reference to Einoah's Dvarim, before that, how does the parsha begin? The parsha, of course, speaks about the sixth year, the seventh year, the eighth year, meaning the laws of Shvius, the laws of Shemitah. If you take a look right after those two psukim that talk about Einoah's Mamon and Einoah's Dvarim, right away, it once again goes back in the beginning, or I should say in the middle, right before, by Ravi, to Chamishi, it talks about the redemption of land, Steachuza. Again, a halacha in reference to Shemitah, Shvius, Yovel, etc. Rav Moshe points out so beautifully, why is it that these psukim of Leisayinu Ishes Achiv, Leisayinu Ishes Amisai, referencing Einoah, not allowing, you cannot go ahead and harm somebody financially, which means you can't go ahead and give him in the mekach, in the sale, something where you're trying to go ahead and make money in an unlawful sense, or you can't violate somebody with Einoah's Dvarim, which Rashi brings down means don't give somebody an Eitzah a bad advice. Why are these two concepts between the laws of Shvius, the laws of Shemitah? Why? Rav Moshe says so beautifully, we know, of course, that the laws of Shemitah are primarily to teach us bitachon in Hashem. Emunah and bitachon, faith and implicit trust. Emunah that I know it, but bitachon means that I actualize that knowledge and I act with that emunah, that becomes bitachon in Hashem. You're telling me not to touch the field during the seventh year. A person who keeps those laws has bitachon in Hashem. One who chalila violates those laws of Shemitah clearly shows they don't have bitachon, implicit faith and trust in Hashem. Reb Moshe says the same thing is true when it comes to Einoah's Dvarim and Einoah's Mamayim. These laws of Einoah, where you harm somebody financially in a monetary sense because you charge something for the item that you shouldn't have, or that you harmed the person verbally because you went ahead and gave bad advice, both of those also stem from a lack of bitachon. Einoah's Dvarim and Einoah's Mamon and your violation of them also, like violating the laws of Shemitah, also stems from your lack of bitachon. Rav Moshe says that's why they are placed between the laws of Shvius, because Einoah also represents you're lacking in bitachon in Hashem. And Rav Moshe explains so beautifully, because if you would be batuach in your parnasa, if you would believe what Chazal say, that a person's parnasa, kitzuvim loyme Rosh Hashanah, is already established. Of course we have to do our hishtadlus during the year, but that the parnasa is already established from Rosh Hashanah for the upcoming year, then a person, if they truly have bitachon and believe that, then they wouldn't violate Einoah. They wouldn't violate Einoah's Mamayim by making a mekach and a sale that's unfair. What do you mean that you're charging more for the item? But wait a second. Don't you have bitachon that your parnasa was already established on Rosh Hashanah? If you really had bitachon, you would not be in violation of einos mamon by charging whatever the sum is that you shouldn't be, and unlawfully you're charging for the mekach. And you wouldn't be giving your friend bad advice. Perhaps you're going ahead and giving your friend bad advice for whatever reason. That also stems from a lack of bitachon in Hashem. So Rav Moshe so beautifully sets the scene for us and tells us that einos mamon and einos dvarim is put in between all the laws of Shemitah and Yovel and Shviyas to teach us, just as that and not keeping those halachas represent you're lacking bitachon in Hashem. If you are a person who violates oina'a, you abuse and aggrieve and harm someone in a monetary sense, in a verbal sense, it also stems from your lack of bitachon. And it's that that will be a beautiful springboard to what we brought down this past Shabbos. Yes, it was in Parshas Emor, but Baruch Hashem, the Olam was so taken by the pshat that although for some it will be repetition, and I certainly hope you appreciate the chazara, but it's a beautiful segue from what Moshe just said. These halachos are to remind us, bitachon in Hashem. Hashem runs the world. We have to have the implicit faith, the implicit trust, the emunah and the bitachon, and that our parnas is already established from Rosh Hashanah. And we spoke about making Torah Chakeva, our Avodas Hashem, our learning of Torah, of prime importance. My Rav Rabbi said, the people who get sidetracked, the people who spend too much time where they shouldn't, the people who do not, or who go ahead and dedicate too much time to everything else, as Rav Moshe says, essentially it's stemming from a lack of bitachon. And this is what we mentioned on Shabbos. If you'll turn back, please, to Parshas Emor. Please turn back with me to Parshas Emor. If you take a look, Perek Chof Beis. I'm sorry, I apologize. Chof Gimel. Pasuk Yud. There in last week's Parsha, it's talking about the Omer. By the way, I feel very comfortable talking about the Omer because we're in the middle of Sfiras Omer. We're but 2 weeks, even less than that, from Shavuot, and we talk about the Karban Omer. Did you count Sfiras Omer? We're in the middle of the Omer. We're in the middle of counting the Omer, the Karban Omer. There's so much talk about the Omer, the Omer, the Omer, the Omer. Do you know, pray tell, what the Omer is? And this is what we said Shabbos in the Drush. If you take a look, the Pasuk says, you're bringing the Omer. Take a look at the next Pasuk. You should wave the Omer at the end of that Pasuk. The word Omer again and again and again. What is this Omer? So let's start with the basics, because the Ber Yosef asks some questions that are so powerful, so fundamental, so insightful, you literally should realize that it changes our whole Havana in counting the Omer approaching Kabbalah Satayra. And this is basically what the Ber Yosef tells us. Number one, isn't it funny that you are talking about bringing the Omer? The Omer is a dry measure. I believe it's the equivalent of 43.2 eggs, the volume of. The Omer is actually the measure of Asiras HaEifah, a tenth of an eifah. In fact, more often than not, that measure is not called an Omer, but early, if you take a look earlier in Vayikra, it's actually called again and again, Asiras HaEifah, a tenth of an eifah. So although the volume, the dry measure of Omer and Asiras HaEifah are one and the same, why does it go out of its way here to call it by the name Omer again and again, when we find other times it's referred to as Asiras Ha'efa? In other words, why doesn't this pasuk say the Havesim S, Asiras Ha'efa, when you bring the carbon whose volume is a tenth of an Efa? Why the word Omer instead of Asiras Ha'efa? Next, why is the carbon called carbon Omer? Isn't that unusual? Call the carbon based on what you're bringing. Call it carbon sa'irim. It's the carbon of wheat or the carbon of barley. But you're calling it a carbon based on its dry measure volume? Like, would you call it a carbon 13.2 fluid ounces? What? Call it carbon sa'irim. Call it by the name. Kolis, the carbon of barley, the carbon of wheat. But the carbon of Omer, as if the point of it is its measurement. And we go through these 7 weeks. I'm counting the Omer. Sfiras Omer. Did you count the Omer? Another day of the Omer as we approach Kabbalah Satorah. How, pray tell, is the Omer Hachana and the ultimate preparation for Kabbalah Satorah? These three questions should bother you. The Ber Yosef tells us something so stunning. I'm so grateful to you, Rabbi Buchstein, for bringing this Ber Yosef to my attention. If you take a look, well, let me begin a little bit differently. The Gemara tells us at the end of Megillah, we know the Torah was only given to those in the generation of the Eichle Haman. Why? The Hezbro of the Gemara is because the Eichle Haman got their sustenance, their parnasa, their food every day. An exact amount was given, as Rashi says, not more, not less. That means that they weren't busy, so to speak, with making parnasa. They weren't consumed with their malacha. They were able to stay focused and make Torah Chokeva, my avodas Hashem, my limud haTorah, my clinging tenaciously to the way of the Torah. That becomes my ikar, my focus in life. In other words, they were able to have clear, with tzlilus hadas, clear knowledge about what it meant to receive the Torah. And that's the Hezbro and the Gemara. The ones who were able to properly prepare and to receive the Torah were the Eichle Haman, because the Eichle Haman were not excessively busy with their parnasa and the money and the daigas and the worrying and what to do, because they got the man each and every day, you know, twice on Friday for Shabbos. They always got the same amount of man. So that meant that their mind was clear and able to think of Avodas Habari and service of Hashem and a life where the prime is Limud HaTorah. That's the generation that's able to go ahead and be Mekabel the Torah. The Gemara in Kiddushin on Lamed Ches tells us that the man fell and the man stopped falling on Zion Adar, the Zion Adar Meis Moshe, and when Moshe Rabbeinu died, the man stopped. But the Gemara in Kiddush Lamed Ches tells us that they still had enough man, bechleim, in their vessels to last an additional, how many days? 39 days. And although it stopped falling on the 7th of Adar, because that's when Moshe Rabbeinu died, the mud was able to last another 39 days until Tezayin Nisan, the 16th of Nisan. And it was on the 16th of Nisan that they didn't have any mud left. That means that it was on the 16th of Nisan that if their parnasa, their sustenance, the provisions, the mud was no longer in existence. That was the first day that it started for them, the nisayon, the challenge, the tribulation, the trial. Now a person had to start thinking about their parnasa and get involved in provisions and sustenance, and that now could become their new avodah, almost as if chalila, their melacha was going to become keva, their prime, and chalila, the Torah, will become arai, but temporary. That was the first day that they no longer had mun on Tezayin Nisan. That was the first day that this new Nisayon, this new trial and challenge and Nisayon started to crop up. And maybe the person now would start to think, I have to do this and that and the other. And Chalila, the person, would make the mistake of making Malachtoi Keva and Tairosai Arai. And if they would do that, Chalila, there would be Hisrashlus and Eithak HaTorah. They wouldn't be as involved in Torah. That day, that challenge, that new challenge presented themselves was, what day did I say that was? Tezayin Nisan, the 16th of Nisan. Oh, I know what else happened on the 16th of Nisan. The 16th of Nisan was the day that we brought the Karbon Omer.
And we ask, what does the Omer mean? The Omer is just but a dry measure. It's more oftenly called Asirah to Eifon. Why do you even call it Karban Omer? And what does it mean? They were both on the same day.
If you take a look, he says so beautifully, you don't have to look now, but please, when you get home, take a look at the Shalach, Tes Zion. By the way, it's interesting because it's Tes Zion Nisan. And the pasuk that we're referencing in Shemois is both Perek Tes Zion and Pasuk Tes Zion. I believe that's a bit fascinating. But if you take a look at that pasuk is talking about the one, and the pasuk says, Tes Zion, Parshas B'Shach, Ish Lefi Ochlein, every person according to their mouth. And Rashi says everyone had the same amount. What is the amount? The next pasuk, that pasuk tells us the next word. Omer! Omer Lazulgorles, meaning to say the amount of the mon that every person got, as Rashi says, not more and not less. What was that amount? The amount was an Asirah Se'efa. Wasn't it an Asirah Se'efa? The amount was in Omer. That means, says the Ber Yosef, when our Pesukim in Parshas Bahar keep using the word Omer, 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 it's not merely referencing a tenth of an Eifa. The Omer is to remind you, and it's a reference to go back to Parshas B'Shalach, where it uses the word Omer in reference to the Mun. Why today do you have to remember the Omer of the Mun? Because today is Tes Zion Nisan. It's after the 39 days. There's no longer any mon. If there's no longer any mon, it is precisely on this day, that I might erroneously make the mistake and now start getting involved with all of the avodah and with all of the provisions, and I may set aside chalila the Torah, chalila, chalila, chalila. So Hashem says on that day, start bringing a carbon. You know what I want that carbon to be called? Carbon Omer. Not merely because it was from barley or it was a tenth of an epha, but to remind you more importantly of the Omer of the Mun. The Mun, every person got, as Rashi says, not more and not less, but exactly an Omer. Now on Tes Zion Nisan, I want you to bring an Omer to remind you of the Omer of the Mun. I want this carbon to be called carbon Omer to remind you of the Omer of the Mun. I want you to spend these 7 weeks counting Sfiras HaOmer, Sfiras HaOmer, Sfiras HaOmer, Omer to remind you of the Mun. And what was the lesson of the Mun? Since the Ribbono Shel Olam provided, you were able to correctly make Toiros HaKeva, my prime importance to learn. And that, truth be told, is the best way to prepare for Kabbalah HaTorah. And I thought that was a beautiful segue from Reb Moshe's pshat, because Reb Moshe said so beautifully that the point of Shvius, Shemitah, the point of Einaz Dvarim and Einaz Mamayim is to make sure that we remain steadfast in our emunah and bitachon in Hashem. When one has that bitachon in Hashem, they're able to lead a life of Toiros HaKeva. And that's why says the Ber Yosef, answering all the questions, why are you calling the carbon Omer? Why, when measuring the amount, don't you say Asirah Se'efa? What does it mean, Asirah HaOmer, Asirah HaOmer? All of that reference of Omer is to remind you of which Omer? The Omer and B'Shalach, Tes Zion. Interesting, they're both Tes Zion, as we said earlier. Because on Tes Zion Nisan, there was no longer any mud. On that day that there was no longer any mud, it was the first day that a new Nisayon, a new test and challenge would now arise, and that is, are you going to, Chalila, weaken your being Isaac and Tyra? Are you going to get involved and get consumed in the sustenance, the work, the provisions, the Avodah? Don't do that. Hence the name Karban Omer. Precisely on Tes Zion Nisan, it begins on the very day Tes Zion Nisan, when they no longer have the provisions, to remind us Omer, 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 Omer. Just as with the Mun, we had the Bitachon that our Parnasa was Kesuvin, it was established and set already on Rosh Hashanah. That should give us a peace, a tranquility. Of course, we do Harishtavos. But we should live with the bitachon, the peace, the tranquility, the implicit trust in Hashem, so that we're able to properly be mechin for Kabbalah Satorah. Before I go to the final part of the shir, I must tell you, after I said this pshat, which I think is one of the most extraordinary, enlightening, powerful pshatim beyond, after one of the minyanim this past Shabbos, Reb Daniel Gross brought from Rashi a fabulous raya, a stellar raya to this pshat of the Ber Yosef. If you take a look when Rashi is talking in Parshas Emor about the Omer, give me a moment to find the Rashi. Rashi tells us, I'm talking about the Rashi in Chof Gimel Pasuk Yud, on the word Omer, you can look it up at home again, Emor Chof Gimel Yud. Rashi says on the word Omer, Asiras Ha'efa, it's the volume of a tenth of an Efa, which indeed we know that. And then when Rashi wants to tell us where you find usage of this word Omer, Rashi tells us, in that Rashi I just quoted, Kachoysa Shema, that's the name of what it is, Kimo, and where do you find usage of this? Zok Rashi turned back to Beshalach Tez Zayin Yud Ches, where the Pasuk says, Vayamoidu Ba'Omer, they measured the Omer. And you have to wonder, what does Rashi mean? If Rashi is trying to tell us that an Omer is an Asir Sa'efa, there are many, many times you can find other psukim referencing the Omer, certainly a few, as an Asir Sa'efa. Why does Rashi and Parshas Emor refer us way back to Parshas Beshalach, to the Mun of Vayamaydu Ba'Omer? They measured the Omer. Why does Rashi go to that Omer when there are other times as well? But according to the Ber Yosef, it's beautiful. Rashi is deliberately going back, perhaps, to Vayamaydu Ba'Omer, the one in Beshalach, because that Omer is a reference to the Mun. And each time you have the Karbon Omer, Sirus Omer, the Hadesimus Omer, the Hainethes Omer, it's all a reference to the Omer of the Mun, to remind you to stay focused. And the best way to prepare for Kabbalah Satorah and Shavuos, and the best way to be Mechen, is by remembering, with that bitachon, and Emunah in Hashem, the lesson of Shavuos, the lesson of Einaz Dvarim, the lesson of Einaz Mamayin, we can stay focused and spend our time on Tairos HaKeva. Now that's preparing for Shavuos and Kabbalah Satorah. Allow me, just with a few minutes left to the share, to quickly tell you a pshat. As we began with a pshat from Reb Moshe, I want to conclude with a pshat from Reb Moshe. Look it up in Darash Moshe. I must tell you, it is one of the most powerful pshatim you will ever hear. Please take a look in Parshas Bahar to Chof Hei Chavav, and with this we'll conclude the shir. This is talking about Snei Achuza, a field of the ancestors, and basically how it could be redeemed, who has to redeem it. If you take a look very quickly at Chof Hei and Chavav, the Pasuk speaks about Bechiyamo Chachicha, your brother became impoverished, and he has to sell his Stei Achuza. The Pasuk goes on to say the one redeemer who's closest to him should redeem it. And then Pasuk Chavav, Ish Ki Lo Yihyeh Lo Goyel. If that man does not have a redeemer, then the Pasuk goes on to tell you what has to happen. He doesn't have a redeemer. Take a look at Rashi on the words of Ish Kulo Yagoyel, Zok Rashi. Is there a person in Klal Yisrael who doesn't have a relative, a Karev, who's his redeemer? Everybody has a relative. It could be a cousin, a brother, a 19th cousin, a 48th cousin. Elsewhere, Rashi is Masbrik, because talking about a ger, because a ger would not have somebody who's a karav, who's a relative of theirs, who's Jewish. Here, Rashi doesn't say that. Rashi asks, is there a person in Klal Yisrael that doesn't have a redeemer, meaning to say, there's got to be some blood relative, somebody, even if it's a distant car of a relative. Somebody's got to be a redeemer. Everybody has a car. So Rashi says, Ella, what it means is, he does have a karev, he does have a goyel, he does have a redeemer. Goyel sheyuchal, he has a redeemer who has the financial means to go ahead and redeem what the seller has sold. But Rashi understands the pasuk to mean he does have a karev. Are you getting this down? You know it's critically important because Zuck Rashi, he does have a redeemer, but not a redeemer that is willing to bail out his relative. Not a redeemer that is going to be willing to redeem what the seller had sold. Okay, that's what Rashi learns.
So Rav Moshe asks the kasha, why then does the pasuk word it by saying, ki lo yielo goyel, he doesn't have a redeemer? Why not say he has a karev, he has a redeemer, but it's one that's not willing to redeem? Isn't that what Rashi means? So if that's what Rashi means, look at Rav Moshe inside. I'm pointing to the Rav Moshe. Look at it inside. Why doesn't the pasuk say that he has a goyel, but it's a goyel that's not willing to redeem or to help? Why instead does the pasuk use the words ki lo yielo goyel as if he doesn't have a redeemer? He does, just not one that's willing.
I think from some facial recognition, you already have the answer. Look at Reb Moshe inside to see the words. Zot Reb Moshe. You know why the pasuk uses the words that he has no redeemer? Reb Moshe says, there is a relative, there is a redeemer. However, when a person has a karov, that relative, she'einoi mis'anin b'matzovei shel kroivoi,
he doesn't feel the pain of the one who needs to be redeemed. He's not willing to step up and to feel the pain, feel the massive of his relative, lehetivloi, to make it better for him. Zok Reb Moshe, nechshav ke'einoi kroivoi. Nechshav ke'einoi kroivoi. It's considered as if he has no karov. It's considered as if he has no goyel. And that's why the pasuk words it that way. You ask the kasha, why not say he has a karov, he has a goyel, but one who's there but not willing to redeem? Because if you're not willing to redeem, if you're not willing to be a goyel, then you're not a karev.
A karev, by definition, means someone who's willing to help. Or at the very least, if can't help and feels the pain, misanin b'matzovei shel kroivoi, he feels the pain, he wishes he could help, whatever it might be, zok Reb Moshe. The pasuk goes out of its way to say, ein. He lo yielo goyel. He doesn't have a goyel. I we ask. He does, just not willing to help. Because if the person has that karov, that goyel, but he's not misanin b'matzovei shel kroivoi lehetivloi, to make it better for him, and he doesn't care enough to redeem for his relative, nechshav ke'einai kroivoi. It's like he has no relative. Because a karov by definition is, I help you. What a pshat. And that's why when we approached Kabbalah Satorah, it says, Vayichad Shom Yisrael Neged Ahar, singular, Zok Rashi, Ish Echad Lev Echad, one heart, one person, united in purpose. Because that's a Karev. And now you're a Karev? Now you're ready for Kabbalah Satorah. Because somebody who helps a relative, who helps another person, and if they can't help but wants to help, desires to help, feels pain that they can. Now that's a karev. That's a relative. That's what it means. Kol Yisrael Arevim Zebezeh. We help each other. And that's why as preparation to be making for Kabbalah Satorah, we needed to achieve a level of Vayichan. Vayichan is singular. Ish Echad Lev Echad, united in purpose, united as one, united in heart. We were craving. Now you're craving. Now you're ready to be Mekabel Satorah. May we talk of these Zaychen. To act as craven, behave as craven, be there for each other, have bitachon in the Bayri Yoylam. It's the best way to be meichin for a beautiful Kabbalah Satorah. Haba aleinu l'tayvah.